He did not remember when he had first started to talk aloud when he was by himself. He had sung when he was by himself in the old days, and he had sung at night sometimes when he was alone steering on his watch in the smacks or in the turtle boats. He had probably started to talk aloud when alone when the boy had left. But he did not remember. When he and the boy fished together, they usually spoke only when it was necessary. They talked at night or when they were storm-bound by bad weather. It was considered a virtue not to talk unnecessarily at sea, and the old man had always considered it so and respected it. But now he said his thoughts aloud many times, since there was no one that they could annoy. "If the others heard me talking out loud, they would think that I am crazy," he said aloud. "But since I am not crazy, I do not care. And the rich have radios to talk to them in their boats and to bring them the baseball." Now is no time to think of baseball, he thought. Now is the time to think of only one thing, that which I was born for. There might be a big one around that school, he thought. I picked up only a straggler from the albacore that were feeding. But they are working far out and fast. Everything that shows on the surface today travels very fast, and to the northeast. Can that be the time of day? Or is it some sign of weather that I do not know? He could not see the green of the shore now, but only the tops of the blue hills that showed white as though they were snow-capped, and the clouds that looked like high snow mountains above them. The sea was very dark, and the light made prisms in the water. The myriad flecks of the plankton were annulled now by the high sun, and it was only the great deep prisms in the blue water that the old man saw now, with his lines going straight down into the water that was a mile deep. The tuna, the fishermen called all the fish of that species tuna, and only distinguished among them by their proper names when they came to sell them or to trade them for baits, were down again. The sun was hot now, and the old man felt it on the back of his neck and felt the sweat trickle down his back as he rowed. I could just drift, he thought, and sleep, and put a bite of line around my toe to wake me. But today is 85 days, and I should fish the day well. Just then, watching his lines, he saw one of the projecting green sticks dip sharply. "Yes," he said, "yes," and shipped his oars without bumping the boat. He reached out for the line and held it softly between the thumb and forefinger of his right hand. He felt no strain nor weight, and he held the line lightly. Then it came again. This time it was a tentative pull, not solid nor heavy, and he knew exactly what it was. 100 fathoms down, a marlin was eating the sardines that covered the point and the shank of the hook where the hand-forged hook projected from the head of the small tuna. The old man held the line delicately and softly with his left hand, unleashed it from the stick. Now he could let it run through his fingers without the fish feeling any tension. This far out, he must be huge in this month, he thought. Eat them, fish. Eat them. Please eat them. How fresh they are, and you down there 600 feet in that cold water in the dark. Make another turn in the dark and come back and eat them. He felt the light, delicate pulling, and then a harder pull, when a sardine's head must have been more difficult to break from the hook. Then there was nothing. "Come on," the old man said aloud. "Make another turn. Just smell them. Aren't they lovely? Eat them good now, and then there is the tuna. Hard and cold and lovely. Don't be shy, fish. Eat them." He waited with the line between his thumb and his finger, watching it and the other lines at the same time, for the fish might have swum up or down. Then came the same delicate pulling touch again. "He'll take it," the old man said aloud. "God help him to take it." He did not take it, though. He was gone, and the old man felt nothing. "He can't have gone," he said. "Christ knows he can't have gone. He's making a turn. Maybe he has been hooked before, and he remembers something of it." Then he felt the gentle touch on the line, and he was happy. "It was only his turn," he said. "He'll take it." He was happy, feeling the gentle pulling, and then he felt something hard and unbelievably heavy. It was the weight of the fish, and he let the line slip, down, 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 unrolling off the first of the two reserve coils. As it went down, slipping lightly through the old man's fingers, he still could feel the great weight, though the pressure of his thumb and finger were almost imperceptible. "What a fish," he said. "He has it sideways in his mouth now, and he is moving off with it. Then he will turn and swallow it," he thought. He did not say that, because he knew that if you said a good thing, it might not happen. He knew what a huge fish this was, and he thought of him moving away in the darkness with the tuna held crosswise in his mouth. At that moment, he felt him stopping, but the weight was still there. Then the weight increased, and he gave more line. He tightened the pressure of his thumb and finger for a moment, and the weight increased and was going straight down. "He's taken it," he said. "Now I'll let him eat it well." He let the line slip through his fingers while he reached down with his left hand and made fast the free end of the two reserve coils to the loop of the two reserve coils of the next line. Now he was ready. He had 3 40-fathom coils of line in reserve now, as well as the coil he was using. "Eat it a little more," he said. "Eat it well. Eat it so that the point of the hook goes into your heart and kills you," he thought. "Come up easy and let me put the harpoon into you." "All right. Are you ready? Have you been long enough at table?" "Now," he said aloud, and struck hard with both hands, gained a yard of line, and then struck again and again, swinging with each arm alternately on the cord with all the strength of his arms and the pivoted weight of his body. Nothing happened. The fish just moved away slowly, and the old man could not raise him an inch. His line was strong and made for heavy fish, and he held it against his back until it was so taut that beads of water were jumping from it. Then it began to make a slow hissing sound in the water, and he still held it, bracing himself against the thwart and leaning back against the pole. The boat began to move slowly off toward the northwest. The fish moved steadily, and they traveled slowly on the calm water. The other baits were still in the water, but there was nothing to be done. "I wish I had the boy," the old man said aloud. "I'm being towed by a fish, and I'm the towing bit. I could make the line fast, but then he could break it. I must hold him all I can and give him line when he must have it. Thank God he is traveling and not going down. What I will do if he decides to go down, I don't know. What I'll do if he sounds and dies, I don't know. But I'll do something. There are plenty of things I can do." He held the line against his back and watched its slant in the water and the skiff moving steadily to the northwest. "This will kill him," the old man thought. "He can't do this forever." But 4 hours later, the fish was still swimming steadily out to sea, towing the skiff, and the old man was still braced solidly with the line across his back. "It was noon when I hooked him," he said, "and I have never seen him." He had pushed his straw hat hard down on his head before he hooked the fish, and it was cutting his forehead. He was thirsty, too, and he got down on his knees and, being careful not to jerk on the line, moved as far into the bow as he could get and reached the water bottle with one hand. He opened it and drank a little. Then he rested against the bow. He rested sitting on the unstepped mast and sail and tried not to think, but only to endure. Then he looked behind him and saw that no land was visible. "That makes no difference," he thought. "I can always come in on the glow from Havana. There are 2 more hours before the sun sets, and maybe he will come up before that. If he doesn't, maybe he will come up with the moon. If he does not do that, maybe he will come up with the sunrise. I have no cramps, and I feel strong. It is he that has the hook in his mouth. But what a fish to pull like that. He must have his mouth shut tight on the wire. I wish I could see him. I wish I could see him only once to know what I have against me." The fish never changed his course nor his direction all that night, as far as the man could tell from watching the stars. It was cold after the sun went down, and the old man's sweat dried cold on his back and his arms and his old legs. During the day, he had taken the sack that covered the bait box and spread it in the sun to dry. After the sun went down, he tied it around his neck so that it hung down over his back, and he cautiously worked it down under the line that was across his shoulders now. The sack cushioned the line, and he had found a way of leaning forward against the bow so that he was almost comfortable. The position, actually, was only somewhat less intolerable, but he thought of it as almost comfortable. "I can do nothing with him, and he can do nothing with me," he thought, "not as long as he keeps this up." Once he stood up and urinated over the side of the skiff and looked at the stars and checked his course. The line showed like a phosphorescent streak in the water, straight out from his shoulders. They were moving more slowly now, and the glow of Havana was not so strong, so that he knew the current must be carrying them to the eastward. "If I lose the glare of Havana, we must be going more to the eastward," he thought. "For if the fish's course held true, I must see it for many more hours. I wonder how the baseball came out in the grand leagues today," he thought. "It would be wonderful to do this with a radio." Then he thought, "Think of it always. Think of what you are doing. You must do nothing stupid." Then he said aloud, "I wish I had the boy to help me and to see this." No one should be alone in their old age, he thought. But it is unavoidable. I must remember to eat the tuna before he spoils in order to keep strong. Remember, no matter how little you want to, that you must eat him in the morning. Remember, he said to himself. During the night, two porpoises came around the boat, and he could hear them rolling and blowing. He could tell the difference between the blowing noise the male made and the sighing blow of the female. "They are good," he said. "They play and make jokes and love one another. They are our brothers, like the flying fish." Then he began to pity the great fish that he had hooked. "He is wonderful and strange, and who knows how old he is," he thought. "Never have I had such a strong fish, nor one who acted so strangely. Perhaps he is too wise to jump. He could ruin me by jumping, or by a wild rush. But perhaps he has been hooked many times before, and he knows that this is how he should make his fight. He cannot know that it is only one man against him, nor that it is an old man. But what a great fish he is, and what he will bring in the market if the flesh is good. He took the bait like a male, and he pulls like a male, and his fight has no panic in it. I wonder if he has any plans, or if he is just as desperate as I am." He remembered the time he had hooked one of a pair of marlin. The male fish always let the female fish feed first, and the hooked fish, the female, made a wild, panic-stricken, despairing fight that soon exhausted her. And all the time, the male had stayed with her, crossing the line and circling with her on the surface. He had stayed so close that the old man was afraid he would cut the line with his tail, which was sharp as a scythe, and almost of that size and shape. When the old man had gaffed her and clubbed her, and holding the rapier bill with its sandpaper edge and clubbing her across the top of her head until her color turned to a color almost like the backing of mirrors, and then, with the boy's aid, hoisted her aboard, the male fish had stayed by the side of the boat. Then, while the old man was clearing the lines and preparing the harpoon, the male fish jumped high into the air beside the boat to see where the female was, and then went down deep, his lavender wings, that were his pectoral fins, spread wide, and all his wide lavender stripes showing. He was beautiful, the old man remembered, and he had stayed. That was the saddest thing I ever saw with them, the old man thought. The boy was sad, too, and we begged her pardon and butchered her promptly. "I wish the boy was here," he said aloud, and settled himself against the rounded planks of the bow and felt the strength of the great fish through the line he held across his shoulders, moving steadily toward whatever he had chosen. When once, through my treachery, it had been necessary to him to make a choice, the old man thought. His choice had been to stay in the deep, dark water, far out beyond all snares and traps and treacheries. My choice was to go there to find him beyond all people, beyond all people in the world. Now we are joined together, and have been since noon, and no one to help either one of us. Perhaps I should not have been a fisherman, he thought. But that was the thing that I was born for. I must surely remember to eat the tuna after it gets light. Some time before daylight, something took one of the baits that were behind him. He heard the stick break, and the line begin to rush out over the gunwale of the skiff. In the darkness, he loosened his sheath knife, and taking all the strain of the fish on his left shoulder, he leaned back and cut the line against the wood of the gunwale. Then he cut the other line closest to him, and in the dark made the loose ends of the reserve coils fast. He worked skillfully with the one hand and put his foot on the coils to hold them as he drew his knots tight. Now he had 6 reserve coils of line. There were 2 from each bait he had severed, and 2 from the bait the fish had taken, and they were all connected. After it is light, he thought, I will work back to the 40-fathom bait and cut it away too, and link up the reserve coils. I will have lost 200 fathoms of good Catalan cordel, and the hooks and leaders, that can be replaced. But who replaces this fish if I hook some fish and it cuts him off? I don't know what that fish was that took the bait just now. It could have been a marlin, or a broadbill, or a shark. I never felt him. I had to get rid of him too fast. Aloud, he said, I wish I had the boy. But you haven't got the boy, he thought. You have only yourself, and you had better work back to the last line now, in the dark or not in the dark, and cut it away and hook up the 2 reserve coils. So he did it. It was difficult in the dark, and once the fish made a surge that pulled him down on his face and made a cut below his eye. The blood ran down his cheek a little way, but it coagulated and dried before it reached his chin, and he worked his way back to the bow and rested against the wood. He adjusted the sack and carefully worked the line so that it came across a new part of his shoulders, and, holding it anchored with his shoulders, he carefully felt the pull of the fish and then felt with his hand the progress of the skiff through the water. I wonder what he made that lurch for, he thought. The wire must have slipped on the great hill of his back. Certainly his back cannot feel as badly as mine does. But he cannot pull this skiff forever, no matter how great he is. Now everything is cleared away that might make trouble, and I have a big reserve of line, all that a man can ask. Fish, he said softly, aloud, I'll stay with you until I am dead. He'll stay with me too, I suppose, the old man thought, and he waited for it to be light. It was cold now, in the time before daylight, and he pushed against the wood to be warm. "I can do it as long as he can," he thought. And in the first light, the line extended out and down into the water. The boat moved steadily, and when the first edge of the sun rose, it was on the old man's right shoulder. "He's headed north," the old man said. "The current will have set us far to the eastward," he thought. "I wish he would turn with the current. That would show that he was tiring." When the sun had risen further, the old man realized that the fish was not tiring. There was only one favorable sign. The slant of the line showed he was swimming at a lesser depth. That did not necessarily mean that he would jump, but he might. "God let him jump," the old man said. "I have enough line to handle him. Maybe if I can increase the tension just a little, it will hurt him, and he will jump," he thought. "Now that it is daylight, let him jump so that he'll fill the sacks along his backbone with air, and then he cannot go deep to die." He tried to increase the tension, but the line had been taut up to the very edge of the breaking point since he had hooked the fish, and he felt the harshness as he leaned back to pull, and knew he could put no more strain on it. "I must not jerk it ever," he thought. "Each jerk widens the cut the hook makes, and then, when he does jump, he might throw it. Anyway, I feel better with the sun, and for once I do not have to look into it." There was yellow weed on the line, but the old man knew that only made an added drag, and he was pleased. It was the yellow gulf weed that had made so much phosphorescence in the night. "Fish," he said, "I love you and respect you very much, but I will kill you dead before this day ends." Let us hope so, he thought. A small bird came toward the skiff from the north. He was a warbler and flying very low over the water. The old man could see that he was very tired. The bird made the stern of the boat and rested there. Then he flew around the old man's head and rested on the line, where he was more comfortable. "How old are you?" the old man asked the bird. "Is this your first trip?" The bird looked at him when he spoke. He was too tired even to examine the line, and he teetered on it as his delicate feet gripped it fast. "It's steady," the old man told him. "It's too steady. You shouldn't be that tired after a windless night." "What are birds coming to?" "The hawks," he thought, "that come out to sea to meet them." But he said nothing of this to the bird, who could not understand him anyway, and who would learn about the hawks soon enough. "Take a good rest, small bird," he said. "Then go in and take your chance, like any man or bird or fish." It encouraged him to talk, because his back had stiffened in the night, and it hurt truly now. "Stay at my house, if you like, bird," he said. "I am sorry I cannot hoist the sail and take you in with the small breeze that is rising, but I am with a friend." Just then, the fish gave a sudden lurch that pulled the old man down onto the bow and would have pulled him overboard if he had not braced himself and given some line. The bird had flown up when the line jerked, and the old man had not even seen him go. He felt the line carefully with his right hand and noticed his hand was bleeding. "Something hurt him then," he said aloud, and pulled back on the line to see if he could turn the fish. but when he was touching the breaking point, he held steady and settled back against the strain of the line. "You're feeling it now, fish," he said. "And so, God knows, am I." He looked around for the bird now, because he would have liked him for company. The bird was gone. "You did not stay long," the man thought. "But it is rougher where you are going until you make the shore." "How did I let the fish cut me with that one quick pull he made? I must be getting very stupid. Or perhaps I was looking at the small bird and thinking of him. Now I will pay attention to my work, and then I must eat the tuna so that I will not have a failure of strength. I wish the boy were here, and that I had some salt," he said aloud. Shifting the weight of the line to his left shoulder and kneeling carefully, he washed his hand in the ocean and held it there, submerged, for more than a minute, watching the blood trail away and the steady movement of the water against his hand as the boat moved. "He has slowed much," he said. The old man would have liked to keep his hand in the salt water longer, but he was afraid of another sudden lurch by the fish, and he stood up and braced himself and held his hand up against the sun. It was only a line burn that had cut his flesh, but it was in the working part of his hand. He knew he would need his hands before this was over, and he did not like to be cut before it started. "Now," he said, when his hand had dried, "I must eat the small tuna. I can reach him with the gaff and eat him here in comfort." He knelt down and found the tuna under the stern with the gaff and drew it toward him, keeping it clear of the coiled lines. Holding the line with his left shoulder again and bracing on his left hand and arm, he took the tuna off the gaff hook and put the gaff back in place. He put one knee on the fish and cut strips of dark red meat longitudinally from the back of the head to the tail. They were wedge-shaped strips, and he cut them from next to the backbone down to the edge of the belly. When he had cut 6 strips, he spread them out on the wood of the bow, wiped his knife on his trousers, and lifted the carcass of the bonito by the tail and dropped it overboard. "I don't think I can eat an entire one," he said, and drew his knife across one of the strips. He could feel the steady, hard pull of the line, and his left hand was cramped. It drew up tight on the heavy cord, and he looked at it in disgust. "What kind of a hand is that?" he said. "Cramp, then, if you want. Make yourself into a claw. It will do you no good." "Come on," he thought, and looked down into the dark water at the slant of the line. "Eat it now, and it will strengthen the hand. It is not the hand's fault, and you have been many hours with the fish. But you can stay with him forever. Eat the bonito now." He picked up a piece and put it in his mouth and chewed it slowly. It was not unpleasant. "Chew it well," he thought, "and get all the juices. It would not be bad to eat with a little lime, or with lemon, or with salt." "How do you feel, hand?" he asked the cramped hand that was almost as stiff as rigor mortis. "I'll eat some more for you." He ate the other part of the piece that he had cut in two. He chewed it carefully and then spat out the skin. "How does it go, hand? Or is it too early to know?" He took another full piece and chewed it. It is a strong, full-blooded fish, he thought. I was lucky to get him instead of dolphin. Dolphin is too sweet. This is hardly sweet at all, and all the strength is still in it. There is no sense in being anything but practical, though, he thought. I wish I had some salt. And I do not know whether the sun will rot or dry what is left, so I had better eat it all, although I am not hungry. The fish is calm and steady. I will eat it all, and then I will be ready. Be patient, hand, he said. I do this for you. I wish I could feed the fish, he thought. He is my brother. But I must kill him and keep strong to do it. Slowly and conscientiously, he ate all of the wedge-shaped strips of fish. He straightened up, wiping his hands on his trousers. Now, he said, you can let the cord go, hand, and I will handle him with the right arm alone until you stop that nonsense. He put his left foot on the heavy line that the left hand had held and lay back against the pull against his back. God help me to have the cramp go, he said, because I do not know what the fish is going to do. But he seems calm, he thought, and following his plan. But what is his plan, he thought, and what is mine? Mine I must improvise to his because of his great size. If he will jump, I can kill him. But he stays down forever. Then I will stay down with him forever.